Welcome to the Human Experience Podcast, where we have folks of all different walks of life share their trials and tribulations, ideas, cerebral chatter, and experiences. We seek to open minds, shed light, and make our modern world feel a little less lonely, realizing that we are all connected, one human experience at a time. I'm your host, Aisha Billy. I would like to thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy. Hi, everybody. I am sitting here with Alan S. Questel, who is the author of book Practice Intentional Acts of Kindness and Like Yourself More. Alan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for having me today.
Yes, of course. I am actually so excited to have you because I have been exploring more about less self-help and more help others. I think that we have a lot of like self-help content that exists in the world, but not as much of like community-oriented, content essentially, whether it's books or people talking about it. So I would love, you know, what your thoughts are on that, like on kindness and community in a general sense.
Well, I think they're essential, you know, and I'm perfectly aligned with your thinking about it. And I have to say that the book didn't begin with kindness. The book began with liking ourselves more. And that was something I explored for a long time in many contexts. And that's something that I consider to be intrapersonal with ourselves, kind of self-help thing. And I think it's super important. I mean, most people, unfortunately, that I meet struggle with liking themselves in some way or another. But then as I kept doing that, I realized there were moments when I did a simple act of kindness and immediately afterwards, I liked myself a little bit more. And it wasn't to, you know, I'm not talking about doing kind acts so that we can like ourselves more. It just seems to be like a natural result of doing a kind act. And that makes it interpersonal. But then, of course, neither of those things are easy, liking ourselves more or being kind, actually. So it takes practice and some skill.
Why would you say that's an interesting point, right? That kindness can actually be a challenge. If you had to explain or think of a reason why, what would that be?
Oh, I can think of a lot of reasons why. And it depends on where we're directing the kindness. So I think directing kindness to others, I think that's a little bit more possible and available to most people. Being kind to ourselves, that's harder. As a matter of fact, when I was writing the book, when I got to the part about being kind to ourselves, I got blocked for about 5 years. And I realized, I'm pretty good at being kind to others, but there's a lot I need to learn about being kind to myself. And when I talk about it as a challenge, there's a few reasons for that. One is that sometimes to act kindly towards ourselves or towards others, it requires a change in our behavior and attitude that is not so comfortable sometimes, you know? And I can tell you, this was an outcome of writing the book that kind of surprised me in a not so comfortable way. So, you know, I have this fantasy, and so far, no one has asked me this question, which always puzzles me. I'm still waiting for someone to ask me, so are you kind? And of course, the first answer is I'm doing the best I can, and I'm still learning for sure. But when I finish the book, and I can say with some certainty that all of the things that I write about in the book about places to be kind to myself or others, I feel pretty good at. I can do that. But what happened was that the next step of me becoming kinder felt like the rung on the ladder was so far away that I don't know if I'll ever get there. So I think that each level of kindness that we achieve and feel comfortable with, that the next level of challenge to be kinder is actually harder, you know? And Can I read you something from the book?
Yeah, of course.
So this is, it's not something I wrote. It's actually a quote from Ram Dass. And it speaks to what I was just talking about. So he says, when you go out into the woods and you look at trees, you see all these different trees. And some of them are bent. You sort of understand that it didn't get enough light, so it turned that way. And you don't get all emotional about it. You just allow it. The minute you get near humans, you lose all that. You're constantly saying, you are to this, or I'm to this. That judgment mind comes in. And so I practice turning people into trees, which means appreciating them just the way they are. And so that quote kind of speaks to more of the place where I'm in. Like, I travel a lot. And so, you know, I can find myself sitting in an airport and looking at someone, and I'm making up a story about them. Right? It could be a positive story or a negative story. And we do this all the time. We're always evaluating others without realizing it. And I would try to remind myself of this quote, but it's too long. So what I finally came up with, if I can catch myself doing it, and that's the tricky moment, if I'm looking at someone and I'm making up a story, I just go, tree. And it's interesting. It's like they blossom, everything falls away. And I'm no longer stuck on my story about fantasizing who they are in any way. And so that's a challenge.
Yeah. It's because our brain wants to naturally fill those gaps. You know, like we want, and especially if you're curious and logic oriented, and like we are logical beings, but we're also totally not logical beings.
Right, yeah.
You know, we have the amygdala, which is like the emotion and reptilian center of our brain. And that area doesn't read logic. You know, humans are so fascinating, but to practice that self-awareness and also what you were talking about, I think, is radical acceptance. Like the other earlier to what you were saying, you radically accept people for who they are. I find, and I always have found our species actually to kind of be a bit silly. And I feel like we are, you know, like
yeah,
we
I agree.
Idealize people, or like, you know, we're maybe too smart for our own good. I think we're the only animal species who is capable of doing something like setting a goal, trying to get to that goal, evaluating why you didn't or did get to it, etc. You know, we are smart. But exactly as you said, if you were to draw judgment on someone, let's say, who looks a type of way, like that stereotypical, like tattoos, you know, let's say you start thinking that they're like a dummy. And really, that person is like pen to paper, like a PhD graduate, and can outthink you in circles, maybe, you know, and it's like funny because you just did yourself a disservice too by judging that person and having that preconceived notion before even allowing the connection two and two.
Yeah.
So I find that really interesting. If you could define kindness, how would you do that?
Well, you know, in my book, I actually looked up kindness and put the definitions in there. And funny thing about definitions, they're usually from the perspective of the observer, not from the doer. So like the definition to sit is to rest upon one's buttocks or thighs. Well, that makes sense. But if you tell a child with cerebral palsy, just rest upon your buttocks and thighs, they have no means to do that. They don't know how to do it. And so for me, the most important thing about kindness is that it's an action. And then we can look at the different forms that the action can take so that I can generate kindness towards myself or others. And without that, all the definitions in the world, they really don't hold much water. I don't think they last in any way. They're an idea. And, you know, in the dictionary, kindness is often equated with generosity.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're the same thing. And I know many people, myself too, I think, in the past, who've used generosity as a self-serving mechanism, as a mechanism to feel liked or loved, and as a mechanism to get attention or to get praise for something.
Yeah, to be the giver.
Yeah. And so if if those are my motivations to do something like being generous, it's not so kind, really. It's an attempt. It's an approximation. And I think that always has to be a consideration in kindness too, is that, is someone on the path to develop this part of themselves? Doesn't mean they're good at it, right? It means, as a matter of fact, I think the more mistakes we make, the worse we are at the beginning, the better we understand something. And slowly, step by step, over time, like the other thing about kindness, like if someone says, oh, that person is kind or you're kind, well, it sounds like a finished product, right? To me, like I was saying at the beginning, I'm still learning how to be kinder, how to create more circumstances. And, you know, I don't know if you've had the experience of seeing someone who you know on the street and you go, oh no, I'm going to have to talk to them. Or you get an email or the phone rings and you see it's their name. And you just go, no, I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned to practice, what I've learned to think, and I have to be very careful with this statement because I don't need to attract more of it. I got plenty, which is those people who I find difficult to interact with, those are my best teachers. If I can learn to be kind to them and pay attention to them, I'll learn a lot. And it takes patience and courage and, you know, it takes time too. So
it's kind of like
a long definition of kindness. Sorry. Yeah,
no, that's okay. It's interesting because the reason I asked about the definition is because words like kindness, disappointment, I'm trying to think of like other things that we have heard since the dawn of time. But sometimes I'm like, I don't know if we actually know what they are, you know? So right. For instance, yeah. I looked up the definition of disappointment recently because I was like, what is this? I keep hearing about it. And like, I think I know what it is. I didn't realize it's like a grief and or a sadness,
yeah.
You know? And I was like, wow, that's actually so interesting because I didn't realize that was a feeling that I feel actually quite often and I hate yeah. it. And now I try to avoid it, you know, in my like yeah. adult life. So when you talk about kindness right now, it sounded to me like that ever evolving thing. It's not like that line. And my soul's journey in this lifetime is one of like high awareness, consciousness, and really like head on healing. And me and like my close friends were kind of on that journey. People who are closest to me tend to also be on that journey. Mm-hmm. And I notice with a lot of us, we want to just get there where we're yeah. like healed and don't feel negative feelings ever right. again. Right. And that's yeah, just yeah, yeah. not how it goes. Right. You don't reach this finish line where you're like, and now I'm aware of it all.
Right.
Done.
Right.
Yeah. So I think with kindness too, if we can think of it more as like this evolving, breathing thing, that gives it more of like, it gives it more room.
Yeah.
You know,
I can give you another perspective about that kind of arrival idea, which everyone has. We think we'll get to the point where I'm done with that, or I don't have to deal with that, or, you know, I have a few experiences. One is that however good I get at being good at something, there's always some surprising person who comes up and kicks my ass again and presents me with something that's unexpected.
Yeah.
Because there's no way I can predict everything that might happen with me. Now, in terms of, I was just talking to a client today about this, who was talking very much in terms of how they wanted to be like, to get to this place in their life, as if they got there, they'd be finished.
Yeah.
Right. And I said, you know, I think, you know, it kind of speaks to the idea of enlightenment. And I have no idea what that means. And I do think I've met maybe two people who seem to possess at least some degree of that, but they're exceptions. They're so rare. Mm-hmm. And the idea that one definition I heard of enlightenment that was great, it said, you get enlightened and then you get enlightened again. And then you get enlightened. So it's this kind of recurring thing that maybe happens, doesn't last. But then in terms of this final resting place of achieving something, I've come to realize that what's more important is how much time I spend in these negative places. Mm. And if I can shorten the duration of time, then I'm better off. I'm not struggling with my negative feelings or thoughts. So that, like the example of tree, right? So, you know, if I'm stuck at an airport with a delayed flight and I'm waiting there and there's someone in the lounge and they're talking loud on the phone and I sit there and I, you know, I keep grumbling to myself. And it's like, how long does it take me before I either get up and change to another seat or I say tree, right? So if I can shorten the space, if I can catch my thoughts and my reactions to things and change that sooner, I think that's on the path to achieving all the things that we want for ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. Susan Blackwell is an actor and a playwright, essentially, who I got to meet and have the pleasure of, you know, working with her a little bit back in New York. And she teaches like these creativity workshops. And one of the biggest things that she would talk about is failing fast. She was like, if you can learn how to fail, but fail fast, that will help you a lot. And I thought, holy shit, that is such a good point. Yeah. You know, I've heard like a business mogul one time say, if I told you between, let's say we're talking in context of dating, between you and the next person you're going to sustain like that happy long-term relationship with is 50 no's. Each no or 50 bad dates, each bad date, you would actually get more excited because you're one down and one closer to meeting whomever the next one is. But we tend to not think about it that way. Right. And instead we're like, the bad dates will send me, or a less evolved version of me, I guess, into this spiral of like scarcity or scarcity. Like there isn't enough there. It's never going to happen. Like they're not out there, or whatever the case is. So I do find that reframing around failure to be absolutely critical.
Yeah. And the example you just gave was a good example of what you talked about before about disappointment. And then, because I'm disappointed that that didn't happen. I'm disappointed the relationship ended. And when you talk about it in terms of it being sadness or grief, that's actually closer to the feeling. The disappointment is the interpretation that we put on certain feelings. There's a great book and body of work called Nonviolent Communication, developed by a man named Marshall Rosenberg. And I quote him in my book. And he talks about feelings that what most people consider to be feelings are really thoughts. They're descriptions or interpretations of things. And to understand the feeling, like if I'm feeling disappointment, usually it's in relation to another person and how they I disappointed someone and I feel bad about myself and something like that. But if I can get to a deeper level of, I feel sad that that happened.
Yeah.
That gives me the means to move on in a different way. As long as I'm disappointed, I'm not going to be able to change it because I can't change my disappointment or someone else's disappointment. What I can do is act in a new way in the future. So then it's like that acting teacher you were talking about who said fail fast. Oh, yeah. So I can identify my feelings. And that's a very hard thing to do, to really identify our feelings because they're so tied in with our thoughts. And so here's something that kind of segues from that, which is all connected to our self-image, right? And so I talk a lot about self-image from the point of view of it being comprised of four things: our thinking, our feeling on an emotional level, our sensing, taking in processing information, and our movement or actions in life. And to change the disappointment, I think I'm disappointed, to change the feeling of disappointment, these things are possible, but they're lengthy processes because they're all tied together with external events and other people in some way. But what's really interesting is if I can change how I act, that's immediate, that's in the moment. And that has a greater potential to bring about the changes that we want. So when I talk about kindness as an action, I talk about it as something that needs to be practiced and studied to a certain degree, but in a way that's possible, not some grand idea of what it means to be kind, but can I just do a simple act every day, you know, towards myself, towards others too? Really simple.
Yeah. I like that the book has random crossed off and intentional. So intentional acts. Can you talk more about this? Because we hear all the time, random acts of kindness. Yeah. Now I'm first seeing intentional acts of kindness.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think random acts of kindness are great. And, you know, so let's not, this is intentional acts isn't to replace that. But a random act has more of the quality of, it's a spontaneous thing that happens in the moment. You know, you're at a, buying a ticket for a train, and the person in front of you, he or she, all of a sudden they realize they don't, they're short like $5. Mm-hmm. And they thought they had it, and they don't have a credit card, and you just, oh, here's $5. That's a random act of kindness. You don't plan on that. You can't go looking for that. An intentional act of kindness is something that we need to like name how we're going to go about doing it and make it something that we can do every day. I can give you an extreme example of that, which was actually one of the big motivations for writing the book. My dad, as he got older, he ran out of money, and luckily my brother and I could still support him, and eventually he became demented and we had to put him in a home. Hmm. And it was in Florida, and his wife was there with him, but she was going back to New York for the summer. And I thought, he's all alone. Everyone he knows is leaving for the summer. No one's going to visit him. And I wasn't really close to my dad. We didn't have a bad relationship, but it was one of those, you know, whatever kind of relationships. Mm-hmm. And I got this idea in my head that I'll call him every day. And I started to practice that. And I can't tell you how often, I don't want it, but just do it. And it's not just do it by ignoring my feelings. It's just do it knowing that I'm not crazy about this. And the minute I'd be talking to him, it'd be fine. And fortunately, he always knew who I was. And I did this for 3 years.
Wow.
And then once he died, I lived in California then. He was in Florida. I would go to reach for the phone every morning. Oh, no, he's gone. Yeah. And now, so that was a good example of practicing 5 minutes. Now, 5 minutes sounds simple, but it's not. 5 minutes is a long time when you're just trying to do that. I tried to give my dog 5 minutes a day. After 2 minutes, I was like on the computer and doing, he would have sat there for 45 minutes if I petted him long enough.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
And I have in my life now a number of people, some friends, some old friends, some new friends. They're of all ages. Some are very old and not well, and some are very young. And I go out of my way to like call them all once a month. And I can say, I would say 75% of the time when I think of calling them, a voice in me goes, nah, and then another voice goes, do it. And so that's an example of something that's done daily that you can practice and that adds up into a sense of it's worthwhile. I mean, I can't tell you how happy they always are when I call. And sometimes they say, no one calls me, you know? And it's like, and I know people have the intention to call, but that's not enough. That's why the action is paramount.
100%. I think about that a lot of like, there's so much that is coming to mind. Like, I'm dying to ask you several things, but with, you know, when you call them, do you find that you're always the initiator of this action? And like, do you ever get fed up with that? Because I would think kindness doesn't want return. Mm. Also, I wanted to note, kindness in my mind, it's so synonymous with love. Like, kindness is love. Yeah. Like, when you call someone, that you're loving on them. When you pet your dog, you're loving on your dog.
Right.
So do you ever get frustrated if by being the one who is always taking on the action?
Yeah, I used to.
Yeah, that's where I'm kind of at. I'm going to expose myself. I'm obviously antsy young woman, and, you know, I probably have more like emotional maturing to do, but sometimes I'm like, I don't want to be the only one who's always acting and it pisses me off. So I really want to hear, you know.
Well, it not only pisses you off, but then you're disappointed. They don't call you again.
Yeah.
Right? So that thing rises up again. So for me, I used to feel that way about my acting teacher. I was an actor before I did what I do now.
Oh,
and okay. We became friends, right? But it was always me calling him. And then one day I realized, oh, that's the nature of our relationship. If I want a relationship with him, that's what I have to do. And another friend of mine who studied with, she would say, well, I don't call him anymore because he never calls me. And I said, no, that's right. He never will call you. You have to do it, right? I had a similar thing with my brother, who we're very close, and I love my brother, and we talk all the time now. But for a long time, it was only me calling him, and I felt resentment and irritation and anger. And then one day I went, who am I doing this for? I'm doing this for me. So if I'm doing it for me, then I'm fine with taking the initiative. The same thing with my dad once, when just after my mother passed away, we were sitting watching TV and the commercials came on, and I wanted to say something to him. And I was 23 years old, and I took a lot of courage to say, Dad, and he went, I said, I want you to know I love you. And he went, I love you too. Click, what's on channel 4? Click, what's on channel 5? Click. And I lay there in the bed going, I can't believe he treated me like that. What's wrong with him? I just exposed my whole self. And then after about an hour, it came to me that, wait a minute, I didn't do this to get something back. I did this because I wanted him to know that I loved him. Once in a while I would say it, but it wasn't frequent. And then the oddest thing happened. After that, when we were on the phone or something, I'd say, okay, I love you, bye. And I just got into the habit of doing it. And it was maybe a year later that we were hanging up on the phone and he went, I love you. And he hung up. I said, what?
Wow.
And I was like, did that really happen? And then he started saying it. So that's another question of like, how long does it take for someone to change?
Yeah.
And, you know, for that, we need to be patient. It doesn't mean while I'm being patient, I don't get irritated or frustrated at times, but that I can keep returning to the place of, who am I doing this for? Is it to get something? If I want to get something, I just better ask for it instead of hoping that they'll do it.
Yeah, that, by the way, to me, like speaking on enlightenment, that actually is enlightenment to me. You know, like I understand our perception of enlightenment is like this holy, like never, you know, I think the mainstream perception of enlightenment is like these individuals who just never get bothered or experience negative emotions. Right. I don't know if that's real or if it's just like high levels of detachment and denaturing yourself. That's my honest personal opinion. My version of enlightenment as a human who is living that full life, right, of all the spectrum of feelings, allowing themselves to explore everything, including feelings like agony and anguish.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly what you just said. It's like, you reached this point where you were self-aware and you knew you were doing it for you. You realize that things take time and that he circled back. It took a year, but he did. Like, you planted that seed and crazy to say it took a year to bloom, but it did. And then you got to see that flower and just like overall a patience, you know.
Well, you know, speaking to the idea of enlightenment, I at this point, I imagine someone who is, I'm going to say more enlightened because I never met the Buddha, so I have no idea what that's like. So someone who's more enlightened, I think, like I said, still encounters challenges, but almost welcomes them.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, now I have to learn how to do this. I never thought I would come to that. You know, that's new for me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's like, a large part of my work is teaching the Feldenkrais method, and I train people how to do it. And in my private practice, when I work with people with neurological problems, so some kind of unusual pain or some real issues, as well around self-image too, that in the beginning, if I encountered someone who was really challenging, I felt frightened. I wish they weren't there. I wanted to quit what I was doing. The whole thing, it would spiral me into this noise for a long time. And actually now, when I work with someone who is that challenging that I don't know what to do, I'm like, oh, this is getting interesting now. So now I have to think more and figure things out. And maybe I won't be able to help them. That's fine. But that's like a flip on the challenge from being it being a threat to something else. You know, part of my book is called Unlike Yourself More, too. And I teach this in every context that I teach or talk in. And, you know, I always say, is there anyone here who doesn't want to like themselves more? And people always kind of smile in a sheepish way. I've never said heard anyone say, I don't want to like myself more. Even if they say, I like myself, great. Do you want to like yourself more, right? And the idea of liking ourselves more is something that when I teach this to Feldenkrais practitioners, this idea, I said, here's the idea. When someone comes to you with an issue that you've never worked with before, or you're not sure how to respond to it, or you don't know what to do, and all those negative thoughts come in, can you shift to one thought, which is, how can I help this person like themselves more? And that doesn't necessarily describe a specific action, but already it's a change in attitude.
Totally.
And that change in attitude is enough to like join and connect with the person as opposed to keeping them pushed away from us. And that's not just in my work. That's in anyone. That's in anyone in your workplace or anyone, a friend who's giving you a hard time or something. If we look at them from that point of view of how can I help them like themselves more, they take on a different aura. Everything changes then.
It's so true. Like that self-compassion. So a bit of a personal share of mine, I went through like a really incredibly challenging loss in 2021, I really couldn't tell you. It was one of those years. And I had to start, and it was right around moving to Los Angeles by myself. Like, my parents are good people, but I don't get any support from them or from my sister, and I'm the oldest. And, you know, I just, it was an incredibly difficult journey emotionally. So I had to start a low dosage of medication because I couldn't stop having, like, I'm very controlled when I'm awake. I do not panic when I'm awake ever, but it comes out in my sleep. So I was having, you know, panic attacks in the middle of the night. So I said, let me start medication. And I met with this psychiatrist who was really, really so lovely and so brilliant, actually also from the East Coast. But she said, we'll get you started on like a low dose of Lexapro, but how hard are you on yourself? And I was like, I'm extremely hard on myself. Like, I'm just starting to realize that a lot less now. She wrote a ton of resources for me, but one in particular was a self-compassion workbook. And she said, why don't you, you know, start working on this? And I cannot believe the research behind self-compassion, self-compassion therapy, and how helpful it is for depression and anxiety. You have the first arrow that, or the first dagger, right, of whatever happened. Then we take a second one and put it in ourselves, working hard on ourselves. So if we can maybe be a bit kinder to ourselves, at least that second dagger is taken out, or you don't get that second dagger, you know? And it's like, it's truly unbelievable how effective it is. It is a practice, and how not talked about it is.
You know, when you talk about that second dagger, like when I talk about, we can talk about compassion or liking ourselves more. I always ask people, well, with this idea of liking yourself more, what are the first thoughts that come up? And you know what comes up almost immediately for most people? All the things we don't like about ourselves. And that's when we have to be really kind and gentle with ourselves, because now we're beating ourselves up again, right? And sticking another dagger in.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
And that's why, you know, in my book, when I talk about practicing things, I'm talking about practicing things that are not really connected to our outside everyday life. Because as long as they're connected to that, there's a sense of success or failure. But if I can find success in something little that's even a secret, like one story I talk about is when I was 19, I moved out of my parents' house. I was in New York, and I realized I had this self-realization, I'm no good at anything. I don't do anything well. And of course, that set me off on a long trip of not liking myself and all was wrong with me. And I could have stayed in there. And I did a lot of therapy, and the therapy helped to some degree, but I figured out something myself that worked better. And I thought, I'm going to learn to do one thing well. And what I chose was brushing my teeth. I brushed my teeth, but it was irregular. You know, I thought, I'm going to brush my teeth well. And if I didn't do it, the only person who would know was me or the dentist, and he already knew, right? And so I thought, I'm going to practice this. And over time, it was a few months of making this, like, I learn well, but I'm not a good student. I don't like to study. So this was something I had to really bring some work towards to do it every day religiously.
Yeah.
And the funny thing that happened, as I got to the point where I thought, I can do this, all these other blind spots in myself opened up that I didn't know I felt this way about myself. You know, and so then I could start to encounter this. But I had that first approximation of success that went, if I can do that, I can do the next thing.
Things really bleed into one another. I have recently been realizing this, like, it reminds me of that saying, like, the way you do one thing is the way you do everything. You know, that's obviously super general, but there's, I do think, a fair amount of truth to that. And things bleed. So when you do one small thing, like the toothbrushing, it's so brilliant. For a few reasons, it's low stakes,
right.
It's doable, it's a low hanging fruit, but it is important. Like dental hygiene is important, or even like cleaning, you know, your room and having a clean space. Motivation begets motivation, you know, like we never want to rely on motivation because it's a very fleeting thing. We want to rely on, you know, actions and habits. But motivation can beget motivation. And I've noticed the flip of that coin is when you go the negative route, like when you start, oh, I'm not good at this. And then it, so I find it interesting that we can actually manipulate ourselves a little bit more easily, maybe than we realize, where we can start doing like small positive things and have that branch.
I'll give you another way that's useful. So, in my work as a Feldenkrais practitioner, there's a body of work where there are classes called Awareness Through Movement, and they're movement sequences that people are guided through, and they affect changes in breathing, posture, reduction of pain, changes in self-image. And they're done very gently and very small, and have one of the underlying ideas beneath them is that it forms a more skeletal connection. And this... I lost my thread there. Hang on a second. So in teaching that work, what I'm asking people to do is to move in a way that you like the way it feels. The interesting things about these movement sequences is no one understands where they're going. They often end up in big movements or different things. But if you don't know where you're going, you have to pay more attention to where you are right now. And I ask the question sometimes. I say, I'm going to ask you a question. You see what your response. Are you moving in a way that you like the way it feels? And if the answer is yes, great. But if the answer is no, that's something to pay attention to. So then in my kindness book, I propose that as a way of being kinder to ourselves. Not that you have to do Feldenkrais, but that if you're getting up to go into the other room to get a cup of coffee or something, if again, you have to catch the moment and think, I'm going to move there in a way that I like the way it feels. Instead of going there thinking about, oh, all this work I have to do and there's phone calls, blah, 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 to go, I'm just going to pay attention to the quality of my sensation, which is not attached to anything other than my own intention and desire. And if we practice that, That's remarkable. You know, a Feldenkrais training, I train people mostly, and it happens over 4 years. And when I first started teaching this idea, it was a program I had in Australia. And I had a remarkable experience at the graduation. So after 4 years, people were graduating, and I'd call their name, and they'd come up, and I'd give them their certificate, and they'd hug me, and I'd hug them. And I can't tell you how many people whispered in my ear, I like myself more now.
Aww.
And I realized they've been practicing just through movement, liking the way they feel.
Wow.
And that kind of enters in through the back door of who we are. But anyone can do that. Every day, if we took
yeah.
If you put a little thing on your phone and just, you know, once every 3 hours it dinged, and maybe you weren't walking to the other room, but maybe you could ask the question, can I get more comfortable? Huh, yeah. I can ask you a question. So when do you decide to get comfortable?
I mean, I would say all the way at the end of the day, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what even motivates that?
What motivates it is I do value rest, and I know that I'll get better rest if I get more comfortable before.
Uh-huh.
So that would be my motivator to like
That's good.
Get comfortable.
That's
at night.
Good. But I would say the majority of people say they get comfortable when they feel uncomfortable.
Hmm.
Now, if you think about that, that's cuckoo. That means I have to be uncomfortable before I get comfortable.
To be comfortable, yeah.
For sure. You know who doesn't do that are children.
Yeah.
Children are playing around, they're drawing. Yeah. They never get up from playing and go, Mommy, I have a stiff hip. Right? They're comfortable. They learn to ignore that. We all learn to ignore that. But to be able to ask the question, am I comfortable? And even if the answer is yes, my next question would be, well, could I be a little bit more comfortable? And I'm not talking about lying down and quitting everything. I'm talking about just a small shift in where your feet are, how you're sitting on the chair, where the computer keyboard is. All these little details add up over time.
Totally. I remember the burning question that I had.
Mm-hmm.
But before I do want to hear, like, I read a little bit about the Feldenkrais method.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a movement, I don't know how to explain it, like a movement style of like how would you break this down for the listeners who don't know what it is?
Okay. So it's a movement technique that's actually built on and based on learning theories. So it's considered to be a process of learning, not a process of treatment or fixing or therapy in that sense. Not those things are all worthwhile. But the learning context puts a little bit more responsibility on the individual, and it frees the practitioner up to discovering things instead of just imposing some idea of a technique work with someone. And as I said before, there's two modalities. One is taught in classes. The other is private, or is hands-on, where we work with people fully clothed. And the range, as I said, are people with all kinds of neurological problems, all kinds of pain, issues around self-image, athletes, musicians, dancers who want to improve something in their life or the quality of how they do something. And there are a few basic tenets to it. The one I mentioned, which is we're looking to evoke a more skeletal use of ourself.
Okay.
Skeleton in movement is the part of ourself that bears weight and transmits force. But we underuse and overuse our muscles. So it's a quiet kind of deconstruction of the muscular habits so that we can become more skeletal. And then another important idea is we're not trying to teach the right way to move. We're trying to teach more choice in how you move. So depending on the context you're in, who you're with, how you feel, how much time you have, you might move differently. And, you know, some of the more common questions that people ask me is, well, is Feldenkrais better than yoga or better than Tai Chi or better than blah, blah, blah? And I go, no. But if you do Feldenkrais, it will make your yoga better. It will make your Tai Chi better because we're interfacing on a very fundamental aspect of movement, which is really around, like I said, we do very small, subtle movements because if we're there, we're interfacing around the initiation of the action. And if we can change something at the very initiation, it then grows into a totally different thing. So that's the short answer. I hope that's
No, definitely. And movement is so incredibly important. And, you know, like even books like The Body Keeps the Score, and you learn about how, you know, our bodies hang on to trauma and stuff. And sometimes, you know how we were talking about earlier, like the amygdala is that like reptilian part of your brain. And then you have your prefrontal cortex, which is more logic, right? So if you're in talk therapy, you tend to kind of, you're like logicking it out. There's other forms of therapy for sure, like EMDR, et cetera. Don't get me wrong. But I have noticed, because I tend to intellectualize, but I also am a dancer, and the movement can target, I think, like that reptilian part of your brain, where you can maybe process something that you weren't able to do through logic. You know what I mean? So I find that exceptional, and I'm so glad to see that methods like this exist, you know, because like you always, I always feel like I already know it all. Like I studied kinesiology in my undergrad, so I've come across so many movement studies, but not movement techniques. And I learned about Alexander technique a few years ago, and now I'm hearing about Feldenkrais method. And, you know, I think it could especially be helpful for people who are super sedentary. Like we forget to explore like the true reach of the arm and stuff like that.
But one of the great things about the Feldenkrais method is that it can work well with someone who's sedentary. You don't have to be an athlete or a good mover. Anything like that. And the idea of well, I'll say one other aspect of the Feldenkrais method, because you talked about something, I can't remember exactly what you said, which I kind of heard is, oh, you're describing the habits that we have in life. And we have habits in our movement as well. And one of the things in Feldenkrais that's unusual compared to other modalities is the novelty. You're being asked to do things you've never done before, to try to figure things out, you know? And, you know, when I was an actor, and actually it was when I was studying Feldenkrais, I was teaching acting and improvisation at Princeton University. And I would teach acting and also theater games and improv. And one of the things I noticed in theater games are these sound and movement games where people, after a few weeks, they're doing the same sound and movements every time. And you could just predict it, you know? So then I got this idea. I did a sound and movement game, and then I did a Feldenkrais lesson, and then I did another sound and movement game, and they did completely different things.
Wow, yeah.
So and people, when I have students and trainees who are actors, dancers, I talk to them, do it like this. So they get to see the comparison between something. But then what's the information that's introduced to you that changes something in our brain, right? So the novelty is one of the things that our brain is like, that our brains like novelty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially my ADHD brain, like that is a, yeah, for sure. I want to ask you my $64,000 question. So I have been in this journey of like unpacking. So you know how like there's community and then there's like individualism. So my parents are immigrants, and they come from a background that is way more community oriented, and I was raised way more community oriented. And you know, I was telling you, I'm also from New York, which I think can really can actually be community oriented. And I don't know if it was moving to the West Coast or just getting older and realizing that people have different ways of living. But I started recognizing that the American culture can actually be like more hyper individualistic, you know? And I was curious, like, do you recognize this? Like, do you find that community growing or like being community minded? Do you ever get frustrated? Do you feel like you're in a society that is community oriented? Or what are your thoughts on that? Like the individualism versus the community based?
So, you know, I grew up in New York too. And I don't think I ever really had a sense of community. I didn't even know what it meant. If people would talk about community, it would puzzle me a little bit. I'd kind of wonder, what do they mean exactly? The first time I encountered a sense of community was when I was married, and I moved to California, and my wife's family was there, and my wife's my mother-in-law, my wife's mother, was part of a Tibetan Buddhist community. And I would hang out there and go, I think this is what community is. And then for many years, I practiced Zen Buddhism. Now, I have to be honest, I love Zen Buddhism, but it's a bizarre community because you're just sitting around not talking to each other, right? And so when you do talk, it's like a stilted conversation because most of the time we're just practicing sitting quietly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here in Santa Fe, I finally developed a rich community of people. And of course, I have my Feldenkrais community, which is worldwide, right? And I travel a lot and meet all these people. And there's some sense of community in that. And yet, within that community, there are some people who I feel much more aligned with, who I become friends with. It's more than just community. But then the community, if I think of community, of a word that describes it, it's a sense of connection.
Yeah.
That provides in me a sense of connection with others that can help me connect with myself more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, any spiritual or religious community, I think that's behind a lot of it.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, I mean, I want to say, I never say 100%. I don't know what 100% is, but, you know, it's always something that's the impetus for it. And yet, I hear about so many religious, spiritual communities that are at odds with each other. And then I realize, oh, this is just normal humanity. It doesn't mean these problems don't exist. But maybe these are the people I'll work it through with.
Yeah. You know? Or even cults, like why cults become a thing is typically because of that, you know, obviously many factors, but that is a huge part of it. And like, I really am into like Brené Brown's work, how she talks a lot about belonging and how it's a thing that all humans want and need and stuff. I just, I find it interesting, like, because I felt a culture clash between myself and like not being as around, I guess maybe it's the Turkish community. Like, not that I even had a lot of Turkish friends back home, but I don't know. There was like a different sense of there. I think in New York, what my experience was, there was more of like that. I know this sounds funny, but like a mafia mentality, like your friends were your gang, they were your pack, and that's who you looked after. Right. And I haven't been able to really come across as much of that here yet. But I mean, I've only been here 2 years, so I really shouldn't judge it. I know these things.
You know, I don't know if this is true for you. And I actually start the book talking about this, about this process I went through with my acting teacher that described all my different roles in life. And we had to get rid of the ones that were least important. And what I ended up with was friend. Mm-hmm. And to me, growing up in New York, friendship was not something that was casual.
No. Nope.
It was something that grew over time, and it took it really seriously. When I moved to California, like, I had someone fixing something on my computer, and it was really a miserable process. It was there all day long. And then his wife called and he said, oh, I'm here with my friend Alan. And I kind of tweaked. I was like, friend?
Yeah.
I'm paying you to be here. We're not friends.
Yep.
And then I realized that there are different values around it. And so what's the value of a friendship? Well, it's a question of how much will I show up for that person? Mm. Like, at some point, if they, can you drive me to the airport? And I go, no. Well, I really need you to drive me to the airport. No. Well, no, because I'm working, or no, because my family or something. But the fact is, a real friend does more, or even explains why I really can't do it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
So I can relate to that. And it's funny, because I came back 2 days ago. I've been teaching in France for a month. And I find that like having dinner there with people is a really different phenomenon.
Yeah, because it's not rushed.
No.
Yeah, I know.
Great. It's just like, huh.
This is what I mean about culture, though. Like, I went to school in Germany for a little bit, so I have experienced, you know, the European culture. And then my family's from Turkey, and I bartended for a while, like in New York, and I still bartend sometimes here in LA. And I see how much it's the turnover, get them out. It's that, you know, hyper capitalistic, like, how many bodies can we get in and out? Where I've noticed like the dining culture there, even it's, you take your time. So this is just a thing that I've been exploring a lot, is like the difference in cultures and all that stuff. But
And it's funny because a lot of people who grew up in that kind of community, they're done with it. And others who didn't get it want it.
Yeah, how funny
is
that?
And usually as years go by, we go meld them both more together and find an interesting place.
How funny is that? That's a really good point. Yeah. I'm glad you made it. Because, you know, you always think grass is greener on the other side.
Right.
But anyway, so we are nearing towards the end of the interview here. Your book, where can we find this if we wanted to purchase a copy?
The first place is to go to my website, which is practicing-kindness.com. And there you get a lot of information about the book and a sample worksheet and everything. And then, of course, it's available on Amazon as a Kindle, or I like to say a Kindle, a Kindle or an audiobook and a paperback as well.
Okay, great. So again, that book is Practice Intentional Acts of Kindness and Like Yourself More. And where can we connect with you in the event that somebody would like to?
On the website, there's contact information for me.
Okay, great. Okay.
And if you can't find that, just Google my name. I have a number of websites and all of them have contact details.
Great. Is there anything else that you want to plug in? Anything else?
That's good. I just want to thank you for having me here today. I really enjoyed our conversation. And
No, I super enjoyed it as well. Thank you so much for coming. And that's a wrap on today's episode. Thank you for tuning in. Please share, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating if you gained anything at all from today's podcast. And we look forward to having you back next.